This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. When I interviewed Amir Questlove Thompson over the summer, after the release of his documentary Summer of Soul, at the end of the interview, I immediately invited him to come back when his book was published in the fall. And I'm happy to say Questlove is back to talk with us about the book. He's the co-founder of and the drummer in the hip-hop band The Roots, which is, among other things, the house band for The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon. He's also the show's music director. He's won 5 Grammys. Among the things he's famous for is knowing thousands and thousands of records and being a much sought-after DJ. At President Obama's request, Questlove DJed Obama's final White House party in January 2017. The story behind that is one of the many stories Questlove tells in his new book, Music is History. It's a year-by-year series of songs that have meant a lot to him, from 1971, the year he was born, to the present. He describes what makes each of those records important, the place they hold in his life, and how they reflect what was happening in America at the time. Questlove, welcome back to Fresh Air. I'm so glad you've come back.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
You have a chapter on blaxploitation films and their soundtracks in your 1972 year, and you talk about Shaft and Superfly, Across 110th Street. So you were too young. You were like 1 year old when those movies came out. But what do the soundtracks from those films come to mean to you?
In the case of Superfly, the reason why it's so connected to me was basically because oftentimes music can also mark tragedy. In the case of Curtis Mayfield's classic Superfly soundtrack, I had an accident once when I was 2 years old. I just got out the bathtub and I was running around the house, and we happened to have we had a very unusual radiator that's made of like metal, and it was almost like touching an iron. And all I remember was that Curtis Mayfield was singing Freddy's Dead on Soul Train, and mid-song, the second that my entire right leg landed on this radiator and practically burned my skin off, the song went to a modulated key. And almost to this day, I get a chill. I mean, I have a better relationship with it now, but back when I was younger, if ever a song modulated and went to a whole nother key, like dramatically, that was like the equivalent of like the boogie monster under the bed, or like it just scared me. Like I turn all the lights on. And so, yeah, I have a very weird relationship with music as well. So it took a long time for me to really get over keys modulating.
So key modulations gave you PTSD.
It did for the longest. Like it was, I was maybe 16 before those burn marks like weren't on my leg anymore.
Whoa.
So
do you think part of the reason you play drums is that you don't have to play key modulations? There's no chords when you're playing drums. I mean, there's tonal shifts, but they're not chords.
Yeah, they're not chords. I really don't know. That's something to think about. That's a good observation.
Well, so which part of Freddy's Dead should we play?
You can go to the scary part. I'm fine. In the middle when the song changes to the next key. That's the part.
Okay, so let's hear it. 'Cause Freddy's dead. Thank you. Okay, that was the part that modulates in Freddy's Dead, which can you still listen to that without getting thrown back into a state of
I cannot fear? Separate my brain from thinking about that moment. The second that happens, it's just put your thigh on an iron for about 5 seconds. Like, that's what it feels like. So
wow. Okay. Let's move forward a few years. Mm-hmm. Now, we could stop in 1978, in which you write about disco. You were seven mm-hmm. at the time. You have interesting thoughts about disco, about how some of it was actually interesting. A lot of it was just very kind of almost like a factory churning it out. One of the things you say that I found really interesting is that you thought disco was kind of tragic for some of the musicians during that period. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I can only imagine that to have to be as disciplined as a musician, to be that disciplined could be somewhat constraining. But I understand that the purpose of it was to play something for 12 minutes so that the party can last longer. And the more that you just stay repetitious, the more effective it is. But I don't know if that's satisfying to the soul as a musician. So that's why I said that.
Something I had to go back and listen to because I hadn't heard it before is that James Brown had a disco recording called the Original Disco Man. I don't know what you think of it. I think it's so bad. You know, it was when everybody was kind of forced to do a disco recording because that's what was selling. And all kinds of people were put in the disco format with horrible results. And I think, wow, this is a really strange example of it.
Okay, so for James Brownologist, there's really two ways to look at his album canon. And really, when you're talking about his true zone, you're kind of talking 1967. Even though he had hits before 67, 67 is where I feel the true paradigm shift of him inventing funk music comes into play. And, you know, every album was absolutely a miracle because he was writing. He was Moses. He was, you know, he's getting the tablets from the hand of God to feed the earth. And then 1975 came and you clearly realized, like, okay, well, that streak's over. Like, we had James Brown, you know, his commandments from 67 to 74. However, James Brown is such an interesting figure because he doesn't make mediocre music. It's either the most life-changing classic music ever or equally horrible music. And the fact that I don't know, I respect, even if it's horrible, it's interesting. In my opinion, he's never made a bad record. It's just what we would deem classic and horrible. He was never mediocre, which is great, fine by me. I have a dream to make a horrible record, like really commit to making a bad record. Because I think at the end of the day, you just have to be interesting.
So should we hear just a little bit of a James Brown horrible record?
Depending on what song you want to
play. The Original Disco Man.
The title cut, yes. That's absolutely positively a great example of that, yes.
Okay, so we're playing this as a curiosity with no disrespect to James Brown.
Absolutely not. I think it's classic.
Okay.
In the weirdest way possible.
Okay. And this is from the 1978 chapter of Questlove's new book, Music is History. That's where this song fits in. That was James Brown during the disco era, where everybody was forced to make disco recordings.
Yes.
It's one of the songs referred to in Questlove's new book, Music is History. Your new book is a year-by-year history of songs that have special significance for you since your year of birth in 1971. For 1988, you write about Public Enemy's album, It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back, which is a pivotal record for a lot of people. I think it was maybe especially pivotal for you, both in terms of like music, but also changing the course of your life. You were working at a 50s-themed fast food place in Philly?
Big Al's.
Where was that?
It was on Penn's campus on 34th and Walnut. All I can simply say is that I think every teenager has that one moment in his life or her life or their life in which the possibilities of what life has to offer is shown to you, and it's up to you to accept that mission or to ignore that mission.
Well, how did that album tell you that you needed to change the direction of your life and quit your job at Big Al's?
Okay, so what makes Public Enemy one of the most important artists ever is the fact that in one fell swoop, they literally made my dad's entire record collection cool, because their pop art, Jackson Pollock method of just throwing paint on the wall and watching these colors blend in with each other, that's how they treated records. So I'm listening to their music, and it's like, wait a minute, that's David Bowie. Wait a minute, that's George Clinton. That's James Brown. That's the Commodores. That's the Barclays. Like, I listened to it one down to see, like, how many sound bites could I recognize from my dad's record collection. And once I went over 100, I was like, wait a minute, this is my dad's record collection in one record. It's like a catalog. I can do this. But it was done in a way in which it just didn't sound like, it wasn't like they were mirroring back my dad's record collection. It was like they filtered it and made it sound urgent. And I could imagine it was like what it was like to hear the Sex Pistols or Bad Brains or punk music for the first time. Like, and when I got to work, I couldn't stop thinking about that record. And when I went on my lunch break, I never went back. I just sat in the park and listened to that record for 4 hours. And I said to myself, this is what I want to do with my life. Like, I want to make a kid quit his job and change his life direction. This is what I want to do.
You were already playing with the Roots, right?
We were a year into it. But, you know, I mean, to be honest with you, you know, the Roots kind of started with a lie. Like, I was just trying to impress a girl that I liked in high school. And I was just thinking off the top of my head, I got a group with that guy. And, you know, I ran up to Tariq like, yo, we got a group in case blah, 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 I ask you, all right? And Tariq was like baffled, like, huh? Yeah, we got a group. And then that's kind of how it was. Like, we just freestyled at lunch period. Like, we did one talent show. And Boyz II Men got all the attention and all the girls crying in the audience and all those things. And, you know, so I didn't truly expect. Like, I was going to follow my father's dream. My father wanted me to go to Curtis Music Institute. In his mind, like, going to the classical route and making, you know, you could make $100,000 a year playing classical music. You know, that was, like, respectable, which is why people always ask me, is it true you really didn't tell your dad about the Roots until the second album? And it's like, yeah, because this is you defying your parents, defying your father. My mother hates when I tell that story because she doesn't want the world to think that she didn't encourage me. She did encourage me, but, you know, to tell your dad you're not going to go to Juilliard and you're going to get a record deal with your high school friend, like, that isn't the reason why he, like, busted his behind to put you in the best schools to quit to do rap music, end quote. So, but yeah, I heard that record and it just absolutely, that was my Moses come to the mountain moment in my life.
So which track from It Takes a Nation of Millions best illustrates your father's record collection?
His absolute disdain for the track Rebel Without a Pause. He thought it was a tea kettle going off and just thought it was absolute noise. And, you know, little did he know that was just his beloved James Brown loop being repetitive. And he couldn't argue with me there.
Okay, so let's hear it.
Yes, the rhythm, the rebel. Without a pause, I'm lowering my level. The hard rhymer, where you never been, I'm in. You want styling? You know it's time again. D, the enemy, telling you to hear it. They praise the music, it's time to play the lyrics. Some say no to the album, the show. Bum rush the sound, I made a year ago. I guess you know, you guess I'm just a radical. Not on sabbatical, yes, to make it critical. The only part of your body should be party in two. Pass the power on the hour from the rebel to you.
Hey, yo, Chuck, man, I don't understand this, man. Yo, you got to slow down, man, you're losing them.
Radio, suckers never play me.
So that's Public Enemy from 1988, and that's a song from one of the albums that Questlove writes about in his new book, Music is History. So I'm going to skip ahead to 9/11. On 9/11, you were in a hotel in Midtown, Manhattan?
Yeah. What makes that day significant was, one, it was Michael Jackson's 30th anniversary, so hotels were booked. And it was also Fashion Week, and all the hotels were booked. So initially, the hotel we had lost our reservation. And there was a brief moment for 4 hours in which I personally was booked inside of the Marriott Hotel right next to the World Trade Center.
No, really?
The only thing that saved me was the fact that usually around 1 in the morning or 2 in the morning, hotels will refresh their system. And it, you know, depending on the computer they have, it takes 2 or 3 hours. I wasn't willing to wait till 5 in the morning. So luckily, one of the people that brought us there was like, look, I got a place at Bryant Park. You could take one of those rooms. And yeah, I left that hotel around 4 or 5 in the morning, not knowing that in 2 hours what was going to happen. So yeah, I wound up in the Bryant Park Hotel.
That's an amazing story.
Yeah.
So you find out what happens. You know, people are calling you and texting you. You find out what happens. And your first response is, okay, you extended your stay at the hotel. And then you paid a taxi driver $100 to take you to the Virgin Record Store, which is a few blocks away. It's just amazing that your first reaction was, I got to get some more music. Yeah. You know, it's like, the world may be ending. I'd better get some more records. Like, what was going through your mind when that's what you did?
I'll be honest with you, I was disheveled because, one, you know, I heard the phone ringing in my sleep, and I didn't know. And when I looked at the phone, I saw that there was 18 missed calls from my mother, and instantly I thought, oh, my dad just died, and I can't take this right now. I need 2 hours just to process the bad news. Like, I didn't even call her back, so it wasn't until maybe 10 or 11, that I finally called my mom to brace myself for the news that she's about to give me. And then she tells me something else, and I'm like, huh? And I turn the TV on and see what's happening. And then I was like, wait, I didn't know none of this was happening. I thought you were about to give me bad news about dad. Like, why else would you call 20 times in a row? And I ran downstairs, and my band was running like, text it. And I'm like, what's going on? And they're like, we're running to Philadelphia. The world's ending. Like, that's how they told me. And I didn't have my luggage. And I was like, well, wait, can I stay here? It's like, you can stay here if you want to, but I ain't staying in New York City. And I just took 5 minutes out. And I was just like, all right, if this is the end, what do you want to do? And I hate to say this, but, and this is kind of the basis of our friendship now, me and Jay-Z, I was just like, I gotta hear what this Jay-Z record sounds like. I can't. So I had my wallet on me, and I saw a taxi, and I said, can you drive to Virgin Megastore real quick? And I gave him $100. I said, do me a favor. Just keep the meter running. Can you give me 20 minutes? I'm just going to run and get some things. He's like, yeah. I said, you'll stay here for 20 minutes. He said, absolutely. And I ran in and just imagine like Flight of the Bumblebee. I rummaged through the entire DVD section. I rummaged through all. I brought records I had already. I just thought, well, this might be the last record store experience I have. So I purchased like $5,000 worth of music.
Wow.
Came out with like 8 bags. And I just went in my room, which is weird enough because I only listened to the Blueprint. I got to my room.
That was the Jay-Z album.
Yeah, the Jay-Z record. That's all I did. I just sat there and listened to it. And a funny thing happened. I liked that record.
Were you not expecting to?
I was supposed to not like that record. Like, there was an apartheid happening in hip-hop between the haves and the have-nots. The successful rappers were looked at as like the compromisers, the devils, and we were like the liberals. Like, we were the creatives, and we put creativity before money. And I told a mutual friend of mine, of Jay's, I was like, yo, I would never say this in public, but I was like, I kind of like this Jay-Z record. And this person took it as a cue. It's like, yo, I have to tell Jay-Z this. I was like, no, don't tell him because he's the devil. And she's like, look, I want you to breathe. This is important. I'm telling Jay that you like the record. And I really thought, like, my career was going to end. Like, what if the world finds out I talked to a rich rapper? And she came back to me and said, you know what? That really touched him because it's one thing for, like, his fan base to like it, but the fact that he made you, and the thing was, like, Common also told her, like, yeah, I like this record too. Like, we were scared to let the world know that we liked this Jay-Z record. That he wanted to talk to me the next day, and I was like, no, I'm never calling him back. So I like avoided him like the plague for like 3 weeks. He wanted to ask me if we would be his band for MTV Unplug, and I just thought that was the most riskiest thing ever. Like, what will my fan base will think I'm selling out if I'm playing with a rich rapper? And it turns out, like, Jay is one of the most, he's one of my favorite people to work with of all the people I ever worked with. Like, it turned out to be one of the best experiences ever, and it changed our lives, really.
Well, we should hear something from Blueprint, from the Jay-Z album that you're talking about. What would you like to play from it?
Probably I would play the Izzo, the most popular cut on that record, produced by Kanye West. Izzo.
Okay, let's hear it.
I appreciate that. H to the Izzo, V to the Izze. For shizzle, my nizzle used to dribble down in VA. Was herbing them in the home of the turbans. Got it dirt cheap for them. Plus, if they were short with cheese, I would work with them. Born in we, got rid of that dirt for them. Wasn't born hustlers, I was birthing them. H to the Izzo, V to the Izze. For cheesy, my kneesy, keep my arms so breezy. Can't leave rap alone, the game needs me. Haters want me clap, they chrome, it ain't easy. Cops wanna knock me, DA wanna box me in. But somehow, I beat them charges like Rocky. H to the Izzo, V to the Izze. Not guilty, he who does not feel me is not real to me, therefore he doesn't exist. So poof, vamoose, son of a H to the Izzo, B to the Izze. For shizzle, my nizzle used to dribble down in VA. H to the Izzo, B to the Izze. That's the anthem, get your damn hands up. H to the Izzo.
That was Jay-Z from his album Blueprint, one of the albums that Questlove writes about in his new book Music is History, a year-by-year history of songs that have meant a lot to him since the year of his birth in 1971. It's been great to talk with you again. Thank you so much for coming on our show. I always really enjoy our conversations.
Thank you. I love talking to you too. Thank you.
Fresh Air's Dave Davies has the next interview. Here's Dave.
Now we're going to hear from an accomplished musician with quite a story to tell. Richard Antoine White is principal tubist of the Santa Fe Symphony and is in his 10th season as principal tubist of the New Mexico Philharmonic. He's also the first black musician in the United States to earn a doctorate in tuba performance and is now a professor of tuba at the University of New Mexico. But what makes his story remarkable is where he came from. Richard White spent his early childhood in poverty, at times sleeping in abandoned houses or parks in the city of Baltimore. He's written a memoir about those who helped him transform his life and about his love for and commitment to making great music. His new book is I'm Possible, a story of survival, a tuba, and the small miracle of a big dream. Richard White's story is also told in the documentary short, Hi, I'm Richard Antoine White, which is available for streaming on the Magnolia Plus platform. Well, Richard Antoine White, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hello, thanks for having me.
You know, your story is certainly one of great accomplishment, but in the early years, as the title of your book says, it's a story of survival. So I want to talk about those early days when you were, you know, 3, 4. You would wake up where and do what?
First of all, I'd like to say I feel privileged in many ways because I only had 4.5 years of a really extraordinarily rough life. Some people have 10, 20, 30 years of a rough life. So in that sense, I feel blessed. For me, living on the streets, I had somewhat a normal life in that I wanted to wake up and play. But in my case, I had to also look into gutters for coins to figure out how I was going to eat. And every day was pretty much about waking up, playing, finding a way to eat, and finding my mom. And at the end of the day, sometimes I would find her, sometimes I wouldn't. And when I couldn't find her, that led to sleeping under trees, on cardboard, abandoned houses, or wherever I could find shelter.
When you went to sleep, were you with your mom typically?
No, sometimes they had a tree, I think, in Baltimore. It's at Riggs Avenue. It's no longer there, but they might be drinking and playing dominoes or something, and I would be under the tree on a cardboard, and then they might wander off, and I would stay there. Other times, nowhere to be found. It was just me searching endlessly, and I didn't succeed every time.
Right, and sometimes you would be in an abandoned home with your mom, right?
Correct.
You tell a story of a little scar next to your navel, which was a relic of something that happened when you were an infant. You want to share that with us?
Yeah, so I still have a scar on right below, I guess it would be my tummy. And I never knew what happened there, but, you know, my uncle and / brother, I guess if you read the book, you'll understand why, Ricky Jr., the son of my adopted father, Richard McLean Jr., is both my uncle and my brother. I asked him, you know, what's up with this scar? We were chatting one day and he said, oh, man, you were left in a burnt out abandoned home. We were called. I came down there. I just panicked, man. I saw all the rats on you. I shot them with a .22. I thought you would be death. So I was scared. Turns out, you know, I can hear just fine. But I was being eaten by rats because my mom was often into her illness, which unfortunately, sometimes is very uncontrollable. Alcoholism is a very strong illness. And when the need arises to serve it, I think it comes first, regardless of anything that's in front of you.
So we were talking about how your early days, you were poor and sometimes homeless in Baltimore until you were taken in by Richard and Vivian McLean. They were a couple who had had actually sort of adopted your birth mother, too. So they became your new guardians, parents. Tell us a little bit about where they lived, what kind of life they had, what they expected of you.
They lived in Northwest Baltimore. Richard McLean Sr. served our country in the Korean War, and he was retired from that and worked for the Mass Transit Association. He drove the bus, so that made me very cool because I could get on the bus and go to school, and my dad would be driving, which was awesome. And Vivian was a shipping and receiving supervisor at Mercy Medical Center. So they were a middle-class family. To me, I even say it in the book, their house looked like Buckingham Palace. I'd never seen anything like it. There were some extraordinary adjustment periods living with them. One, I didn't know you're supposed to eat three meals a day. So they would make me a sandwich. I would eat half of it and stick the other half in my pocket. And they would be like, no, you can have it. Just ask for another one. And I looked at him like, yeah, right. I'm going to keep this sandwich in my pocket. Bubble baths and pajamas. They would wash me and put me to bed. I would put my dirty clothes on, end up sleeping on the floor. And ultimately, I was angry at them at the beginning of living with them, although I recognized that it was Buckingham Palace. I was so angry that as a kid, they have taken me from my mom, that I talked to myself in the mirror, and it was the only person I would communicate with for a very long time.
Eventually, you adjust to school, you start learning. How did you get into music?
Oh, that's an awesome story. So I picked up the trumpet in fourth grade because some musician came, music educator, and displayed all the instruments, woodwinds, brass, percussion, everything, you name it. And I talked to one of my best friends. I said, hey, man, yo, let's pick trumpet because it's got to be easy. Only got three vowels. Boy, was I wrong. I couldn't have been more wrong.
So, you make all those notes with three vowels.
Right. I was like, this one, easy, right? It was not easy. I actually started failing, and I was in jeopardy of repeating fourth grade. And the only reason I didn't repeat fourth grade because I thought I was too big to hold back again. So my parents got this brilliant idea that they would take the trumpet, and that if I wanted the trumpet back, I would have to start passing. I wanted the trumpet back because music was the first time I felt a sense of belonging. You know, when you play in a band or you play in an orchestra, regardless of your ethnicity or your underrepresentation, we all get to choose from the same notes and we all have this common goal. So I felt a sense of belonging. I was going to do everything in my power to get that trumpet back. And I did just that.
Yeah. You know, this becomes a pattern as I read your story. When people tell you, hey, if you want X, it's going to require this, and you do it rather than saying forget it.
I think it's an embodiment of who I am. I think in spite of instead of because of. Because of this, I can't do that. Because of this, this is not allowed. I think in spite of this deficiency, in spite of how impossible this looks, I will show you that I can do it.
So you played the trumpet, but you migrated to, well, not the tuba, but the sousaphone, which is the version that you carry, the in a marching band. How'd that happen?
So I think the transition was trumpet, baritone, sousaphone. I was in band. I was number 18, probably out of 32 trumpets. I looked up. I saw the sousaphone, which was in a Frankenstein chair, because if you're in sixth grade, you can't actually hold the sousaphone. It's too big. And the director first moved me to baritone and then tuba. And I only picked the tuba because it was one. I liked the idea that it was the only one back there. And I never looked back.
A lot of kids play an instrument when they're young. Very few of them get serious. You did. Tell us about getting admitted to the Baltimore School for the Arts, the Magnet School for Performance.
I never wanted to be a tuba player or a musician. I wanted to be a football player and go to a vocational tech school and train to be a carpenter. But I broke my hip just before ninth grade, and the only thing I had left was a tuba. So I showed up on a Saturday at the Baltimore School for the Arts, and picture this, on crutches with a sousaphone. So half of it wrapped around my head and the bell of my body and the bell on top of my head with crutches. Going to take an audition. I'm banging on all the doors, wondering why the doors are locked. This school is supposed to be closed. One door was open because the director just happened to be there this day. And he says, what are you doing here? And I said, I came to audition. He said, auditions were yesterday. And I said, looked at him straight in the eyes and said, but I'm here now. He then said, that kind of determination or audacity led him to say, I have to hear this kid play. Went upstairs, I played a Mozart piece. He looked at me and said, wow, can you read this? Do you know what this note is? He pointed to E flat and I just pushed down my first finger. I said, it's this. He said, but do you know what it's called? And I said, it's this. He said, but do you know the note name of it? It's this, man. And he said, okay, let's try this a different way. He went to the piano, played a melody. He said, can you play that back? I said, yeah. And I played it back for him. And he went, made some phone calls and said, wow, you must be the lucky kid on the planet. We're going to accept you into Baltimore School for the Arts. And to give the statistics on that, if 600 kids audition, they will accept about 35 of them.
So let's talk a bit about the tuba. You know, I think people think of it as a happy instrument, you know, with the oompah sound. When you were in high school in Baltimore at the School for the Performing Arts, there was an open class where everybody had to go with David Federle, who was a big guy. He was the principal tubist for the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra. You heard him. You ended up getting an usher for the symphony performances, and you wrote that you write in the book that his playing was like a drug. It permeated your brain. Can you put into words what was so different and meaningful about hearing him?
Yeah, I first met him in, you know, we have something called Thursday Noon or Masterclass, and he came and played at Baltimore School for the Arts. I'd never heard tuba like that before. I was blown away. And I studied with Ed Goldstein, but Ed Goldstein plays Dixieland, sort of a jazzer. So this was a different orchestral, just magnificent sound. And I wanted to absorb this sound. I couldn't afford lessons with Federle. And I couldn't afford tickets to the symphony, so I figured I'd just become an usher. Then anyway, I could hear him every night when there was tuba in the repertoire. So what I meant by that is that I heard this sound that was just the ultimate sound, optimal performance sound. I wanted to achieve it, but I was afraid that I would lose it because I heard him first at the Baltimore School for the Arts. I was like, I got to keep hearing it. I don't want it to go away. I was afraid that it would go away. So if I was an usher, I could hear it every day. And then I could ask some questions about how to get this sound. And so it became a part of my education, listening to Federle play and absorbing that sound because I wanted to achieve it. And I can hear it in my head now. That's what I base my sound off. And I think it was developed because I got to hear it every day.
I have a little piece to play here of your music. This is not a symphonic piece. This is with the brass quintet called the Enchantment Brass, the music of John Cheatham. Let's just listen to a little bit of this. That's our guest, Richard Antoine White, playing the tuba. You know, one of the things that you wrote is that one of the things you love about the tuba is that the orchestra, that everyone relies on the tuba player for pitch and rhythm. And that's one thing I could hear in that little piece, was that you are kind of driving, you know, this almost like as percussion.
Yes, I think the tuba has multiple roles. I often say in these interviews that my job is to show everyone else how much they suck at pitch and rhythm. And I really hold that really dear. That's my job. And you can sink or you know, elevate the boat however you choose to as a tuba player. You know, tuba players don't make mistakes. When you make a mistake in the orchestra as a tuba player, it's called a blunder. You know?
Because it's so visible.
Exactly.
Well, after all of your hard work, you eventually got a job in New Mexico at a symphony, and I wanted to play a cut from the documentary short made about you and your life. It was originally called Raw Tuba, that is raw as in Richard Antoine White Tuba. You can now see it under the title, Hi, I'm Richard Antoine White, on the Magnolia Plus platform for streaming. This is a couple of scenes where you went back to the old neighborhood in Baltimore after having, you know, been away in New Mexico and succeeded in music there. And we're going to hear two scenes in succession. One is where you say hello to a woman from the neighborhood who remembers you as a child. And then we're going to hear you going to this park where you spent time as a kid looking for your mom, sometimes even sleeping there. So let's listen.
My mom was Cheryl White.
Oh, his mother's name was Cheryl White.
Tinka. My family used to live right here. Grandma Emma.
Emma.
Man!
I'm baby Ricky.
Oh, my God!
Who
Regina,
are you?
Regina, I'm Marie Stevenson.
Yes.
I'm Debbie's sister, Tracy.
How are you doing?
Oh, my God!
How are you?
I remember the last time I saw him, when you go up through here, when you go up Clark Avenue, that school building right there, it was pouring down, raining, and he was standing right there underneath the building like this. No shoes and stuff on. He didn't know where his mama was at. And that's for real, yeah.
I haven't been back here since. This park, this spot, since I was 4. And this water fountain has got to be just as old as me, because it's where I would drink and bathe if I needed to. And I could barely reach this. I would be like this. And you step on this, and the water would, oh, it still works.
Wow.
And I would do this, and wow. It still works. Man. That's emotional. That was my bathroom, man.
And that's from the documentary, Hi, I'm Richard Antoine White, which is available for streaming on the Magnolia Plus platform. Quite a moment. Have you come back to Baltimore more since then?
No, I come back to speak just to inspire hope. And hearing those two scenes, I don't know when it's going to get to the point where I can watch that documentary and not relive it or feel emotional. You know, the first scene that you just played is really important because as we were making this documentary, there were some issues of credibility in terms of how do you remember I was 4? I was like, I actually don't know. I hope I'm not making any of this up. I'm pretty sure this actually happened this way. And so we randomly were picking spots in Baltimore. We randomly picked that time, randomly picked that place, and ran into neighbors that confirmed everything that I was saying. And so the film people immediately put drones in the air and said, Richard, the universe is working with you. We no longer have any credibility issues because the people told and verified my story, which was incredible. And I got answers to some things I was searching for. The second scene was I obviously suppressed a lot of things to move forward in life. So being at that water fountain, what I realized is that I was so small, first of all, that I couldn't reach the pedal and drink at the same time. And so that's how I ended up in the fountain. I just said, to heck with it. I can't reach the water. I'll just jump in the fountain. And I realized in that moment that was my bathroom. So I just broke down in tears. I hadn't really thought about it since. And yeah, it was a magical moment of reconnecting with my past in a very emotional way.
Yeah. When you were living with Richard and Vivian McLean, your adoptive parents, your mom would come from time to time. And one point she shows up with this little kid. she had told you she wasn't going to have any more children. Tell us about this moment.
I didn't know. My mom had another son. When we were on the streets, I had often wished for my mom to have another child so that I wouldn't be alone on the streets. I was told that, you know, she couldn't have a kid. Her tubes was tied. I don't know the rest of the story to that in terms of how she actually had my brother. And when I met my brother, I was already committed to the McLeans and my new family, happily so. And once they left, my relationship with my brother never developed. And it wasn't because I didn't care or, you know, I lacked love for him. It was simply because I didn't know him. And after that moment, throughout the years, my brother would call, ask for certain things. My way of showing love to him was what the McLeans did for me. I would just buy him the latest video game, the latest jacket. And one day he just got mad and he was like, why don't you talk to me? Why don't we have a relationship? And I said, because I don't know you. And he looked at me or was on the phone and said, I never thought about it like that. Well, can we get to know each other? And it changed the whole trajectory of our relationship. We worked on getting to know each other. I'm proud of him now. He's a freestyle rapper working in Dallas. He's married now, and he changed his entire life just like me off the streets of Baltimore now just being a contributing citizen. And I think that's awesome.
There's something remarkable about when your mom, who died, I think she'd had asthma, your biological mom we're talking about, and something she told your brother, William, about her aspirations for him. Share that with us.
You're going to make me cry on air, man. But in her last dying breath, the last thing she said right before passing over was for my brother to be like me. She said to him, I want you to be like your brother. And that still rocks my world because I'm sorry. It really means that she loved me.
Mm-hmm. And when did you learn she had said that? And did you learn it from William?
Yes, because he was so angry that I wasn't there. I couldn't be there. I was in another state. He didn't understand because he was young how his big brother didn't come to save his mom. There was a lot of frustration, emotion. I mean, watching your mom die has to be difficult for him. So he had to direct that anger and frustration that he had towards the universe, and some of it filtered towards me. And he shared that story with me. Obviously, we're both intense and emotional. And it's just a really powerful story, and it's just a really tremendous contribution to how I think about her in that, you know, in the last thing she did before leaving this world is to think about her two kids and to try to give them a piece of advice that would help them be the best version of themselves and help each other.
Richard Antoine White, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Richard Antoine White's new memoir is called I'm Possible, a story of survival, a tuba, and the small miracle of a big dream. He spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberto Shorrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Thea Challoner, Seth Kelly, Kayla Lattimore, and Joel Wolfram. Our digital media producer is Molly C.V. Nesper. I'm Terry Gross.